Thanks for being here bright and early with us. Really appreciate you hanging out with us this morning. I'm here with my esteemed panel for a chat about localizing and nationalizing the climate story. Because as we all know, climate change is a global existential threat, right? But its effects obviously vary. This mic is not working. Okay, there we go. But its effects obviously vary vastly from place to place based on geographical differences, political differences, individual personal differences. There's a real effort currently in climate journalism to make the climate story accessible to all different kinds of audiences. And I'm here today to chat about how we're doing that, and I'd love to hear from you all about how you all are doing that too. So without further ado, I will introduce the folks to my left and then we'll get into some questions. So to my left is Jake Biddle, who's a staff writer at Grist, where he covers the climate, or where he covers climate impacts and adaptation. He is also the author of the great book, The Great Displacement, Climate Change and the Next American Migration, published by Simon & Schuster last year. And his work has also appeared in The New York Times, Harper's, The Guardian, and other outlets. To Jake's left is Miranda Green, who is an investigative journalist based in Los Angeles. She's currently the director of investigations at Floodlight, where she oversees their national investigative team and aids in reporting on select climate-focused projects. She's collaborated with NPR, the Los Angeles Times, the Guardian, and other places. And a two-part series that she co-reported with NPR was chosen as a finalist this year for the Goldsmith Prize in Investigative Reporting. And previously, she was a reporter on the Hill in DC and in several other places that we'll talk about. To Miranda's left is Sabrina Shankman, my colleague at the Boston Globe, where she covers the climate crisis. She was the Boston Globe's first and inaugural climate reporter, and she examines how the state and the region of New England is affected by and is responding to the climate crisis with a focus on climate accountability. And she joined the paper last year after reporting for 8 years at Inside Climate News, where she covered the Arctic. Before that, she was at Frontline at PBS and was also a reporter at ProPublica. Thanks so much for being here, y'all. Jake, I'm going to start with you. So, we're here today to talk about localizing the global climate crisis and also bringing those stories that may traditionally be seen as local to a national and global audience. But to ground ourselves, I'll start by asking each of you why that's a worthy goal, why that's something that we should be doing. So Jake, your reporting at Grist in your book and elsewhere has taken you all over the country to see the on-the-ground effects of climate change, and that's required you to learn all sorts of, local history, local policy in many places. Tell me why that's worthwhile. Why bring those sort of local stories to a national audience and a global audience?
This one work? Okay, it does, right? I'm gonna take it. No, I'm not. apparently. There's a twofold thing here, right? I mean, one is that, maybe it's just one thing. So, I think for a lot of readers, right, who are interested in climate change, as such, which is like our, primary, or one of our primary audiences, at Grist, at least for the content that gets put on the site itself, rather than republished or syndicated somewhere else. It's like they want to know, not just how to solve climate change, right, which is really important, but also like what is climate change at the level of human reality, right? Like not just what is the greenhouse effect, but what does it mean? And this is a source of a lot of anxiety for a lot of people, I think. And so I think part of what we try to do, or what I try to do in part is to show where climate change lands, where it manifests. And when you do that, a disaster or an impact, it strikes a specific place with a specific history, and you can't really divorce, the extra degree of warming that makes the storm more moist or makes the, tinder more dry, which leads to the fire, from the, built environment in a certain place, or from the, financial economic structures that hold that place up, right? So I think that, there's a really, really, really noble goal of showing people who live in a given place, what's happening and in the place where they live. But furthermore, for people who don't live in that place, right, I think that sometimes showing what climate change has done in that place can help other people understand the vulnerabilities where they live, or also just, what to sort of put like a specific face and a specific kind of like to show that specific characteristics of like the human suffering that we know climate change will cause, right? So like in Louisiana, when there's a storm, it's not just a specific community that floods, it's also a set of policyholders in the National Flood Insurance Program, right? When there's a drought in, you know, along the Colorado River Basin, it's not just the specific states and water users who don't have water, it's also a federal, you know, branch of the government that has to make political decisions about how to manage those cuts, right? And reclamation is like a national system that they've constructed. So I think it's like, I'll just wrap it up. There's like a sort of twofold thing where it's like, yeah, you help people understand, you know, what the global causes are for the things that they're seeing in their place, but also you help people who don't live in those places understand what could happen and what are the sort of like, when you look at the flood and Tulare Lake or the fire and Paradise, like, where is that coming from? And also, like, what are the commonalities that, you know, could it happen in other places in that specific disaster? God knows. Circular. But okay, I think you kind of get what I'm saying, right? Well, if not, we'll pull up there.
For sure. It's true. I think, you know, we forget, I think, sometimes that while climate change is obviously, you know, a product of specific institutions, specific corporations, it's also the product of, you know, local policy decisions. And those local policy decisions have very specific, obviously, impacts for the people who live in those places and beyond. Miranda, you've covered, you know, regional and local stuff, especially in the West, but you've also covered national policy on Capitol Hill. And I'm curious, I think that you're the only one here who's really done a lot of that sort of national reporting, and now with Floodlight, you're working on partnerships with both sort of national outlets and local outlets. Tell me why we need both. Why do we need to sort of contextualize the climate story at the local level, and why do we also need that sort of national reporting?
Hi, everyone. I'm Miranda. Thank you so much for the question. Yeah, I am at Floodlight. You know, our model is kind of unique in the sense that we're all collaborative based, so all of our stories we really try to do both jointly with a local publication and a national publication, which seems a lot easier than it actually is, because obviously local, you know, publications want to write specifically for their audience. They think there are key details in their communities that they want to include, and they don't necessarily want to broaden it out and include other states and what's happening elsewhere because they don't think that it's pertinent to the people who read their stories.
Sorry, can you speak a little closer to the mic?
Yes, is that better? Sorry. Nationally, you kind of get the flip side of that. They think that national readers don't really want to drill down and know a lot about what's happening on the local scale. They think that national readers kind of want the high-level news. They want to get the data points. They want to get the singular anecdote, and then they move on. At Floodlight, we've kind of realized that both of those narratives are not really true. Readers are interested in knowing more about what's happening with climate change, and they want more information. You know, climate is kind of a newbie. We used to have a lot of energy and environment reporters, but no one really specifically focused on how climate's impacting us, and climate's in everything. I mean, it's impacting us through business reporting. It's impacting us through even, you know, your local sports teams. You know, you're seeing more snowy days. It's impacting kind of every element of your life, and so it's just the framing of it. I think to get to the point that's, you know, I was just asked, climate reporting is really important to kind of look at it from not just how is it impacting me, but how is it impacting other communities, and how could that also potentially impact me too, because we don't exist in a vacuum. So a lot of the stories we do, for example, we partner with local publications. Louisiana is one of our biggest areas. The people who read the climate stories in Louisiana don't necessarily, you know, it's a really red state. And climate, they view it very, very differently. But it is the impacts of climate change they are seeing firsthand. I mean, they're dealing with hurricanes. They can't get housing insurance. Those kind of impacts that are hitting Gulf Coast communities, that's going to happen in California too. That's going to happen in Florida as well. I mean, these impacts that we're seeing from climate change are going to spread to other communities. So just because it's not happening to, say, a person in Boston doesn't mean it's not going to happen to them in 5 years. And obviously, Sabrina can talk to the fact that it probably is already happening to them. So it's important, I think, for us as reporters to give readers the benefit of the doubt that there is more interest in this kind of reporting than I think some editors or other, you know, talking heads think.
Thank you.
It's a great point, I think. We definitely, I think, should make efforts to not underestimate our readers, to remind readers that there are other places in the world that are seeing effects of climate change that they will eventually see. With that in mind, though, Sabrina, at the Globe, at the Boston Globe, you do a lot of intensely local reporting and regional reporting. Sabrina does a lot of accountability reporting on state and local institutions. Tell me why it's so important to focus on the local, despite the sort of need to remind readers of this sort of global existential threat, and remind readers of the effects in other places. Why despite that do we also need to sort of bring readers that local accountability reporting?
Yeah, I mean, so for a long time I told the story of climate change as a reporter covering the Arctic for Inside Climate News. Okay, so that was a climate-specific newsroom, writing to a kind of specific, at the time, more niche audience. That audience has grown more recently. But going to a place where you could really see the impacts of climate change as they were happening, because right then, at the time, we didn't have the same kind of scientific understanding that the extreme weather that we were experiencing might be influenced by storms. It also wasn't necessarily happening to the same extent. Very different situation now. You can tell the story of climate change in the backyard of any community. In Boston, we have extreme sea level rise. We're on the Gulf of Maine, which is one of the fastest warming bodies of water in the world. We have, I started in, I think it was like late April of 2 years ago, and then a week later we had our first 90 degree day in Boston, which if anyone's been to Boston, you should understand, that's not normal, right? So you can tell the story of this emergency very locally, but the reason that I really dig what I get to do at the Globe, and I'm so psyched that I have an editor and publishers that are kind of supporting this work, is by being a beat reporter that stays. What I'm doing is making incremental progress in shining a bigger and bigger light on what's going on. And to give an example of what that means, one of the first stories that I did was based on an early get-to-know-you call with an advocate who said, how crazy is it that in Massachusetts that has net zero legislation, a law that says you have to be net zero by 2050, our energy efficiency program still will give you a rebate for buying oil or gas furnaces. And I was like, lady, you're crazy, that's gotta be wrong. She wasn't wrong, so I wrote about it. And that led to my coverage of the energy efficiency program in the state and realizing that it was run, much like a lot of other states, it was run by the investor-owned utilities who got to make decisions about this. Now, this is the best tool that the state has for getting people to electrify, and yet it's being run by people who have this major conflict and who are continuing to incentivize purchasing appliances that you'll have in your home for 30 years that are fueled by natural gas. So we shine this bigger and bigger light on it, and we stayed, and we hammered it over and over and over again, talking to legislators about things they wanted to do to change it, exposing different problems, exposing how when they're supposed to be putting in like 100,000 heat pumps a year, the year before they had done like 400, just telling the story. And it helped contribute to some pretty significant change in that program, and now it runs completely differently. And there's hope that it will change even more. There are examples across the coverage area where we've done that and been able to stick around and do that work. And it's not something I've had the luxury of doing before. I was doing a lot of parachuting in, but I have found it really rewarding to stick around and tell this story. And I've been shocked by, in talking to like a pretty broad general audience, how much appetite there is for these stories.
Absolutely. As recently a reporter at the Boston Globe with Sabrina, I can certainly attest to the hunger for those local stories, and also, frankly, for a sort of a local understanding of the bigger national stories. I'm curious, maybe I'll start with you, Miranda, how we can all find the stories that can make a splash at the sort of national level, even if they are kind of local stories, if they're about, local institutions, local sort of or state-based institutions. Miranda, so I'm thinking, for instance, of the award-winning reporting that I mentioned earlier that you co-published with All Things Considered on NPR about attacks on essentially a guy who ran for a seat on a state commission in Alabama that sets energy prices and was attacked. Tell me how it is that you can sort of find the stories that will make that sort of national impact, even if they are very based in a local community.
I actually kind of love telling this story because I think it's a perfect example of how local news and national news can actually really work together and how collaborations actually can give stories a second life. So that story I did originated in Florida. One of our colleagues, Mario Ariza, he's from Miami. He had been a local reporter. We hired him over to Floodlight. And he said to us, you know, in Miami, there's been this really big story this last year about this ghost candidate scandal. Essentially, there was a bunch of different local candidates running for office, and just out of the blue, other people started running against them that had no picture affiliated with them. They weren't giving interviews, but they just happened to have the same last name. And what ended up happening is they were basically pulling votes away from them to let their Republican challengers win. And so a lot of reporters thought this is weird, started reaching out to these people trying to get interviews, and spent the local reporters, both the Miami Herald and the Orlando Sentinel, did an incredible job kind of following the story, as local news places do. You know, incremental, every week, new news came out, a new door knock, a new document they got. And then after a year of coverage, you know, the election was over and they kind of put it to rest. So Mario knew that there still was a treasure trove of documents that these people, these reporters, the Orlando Sentinel had been leaked, and they weren't using it anymore. The main reporter had been on this beat, he was leaving it behind. So he said, why don't we reach out to them and see if maybe they want to partner with us, they'll share the documents with us, and we can kind of do a big picture story, like a big overarching feature for a national audience, you know, because this story is just absolutely crazy. But unless you're a local Floridian and you're really paying attention, I don't think you understand the extent of what went down and how this was happening, who was paying for it. It was all tied back to the electric utility. And essentially what they found out is that Florida Power & Light, which is the biggest utility in the country, was paying a contracting group to hire and pay these individuals to run for office, right? It's actually under investigation currently. This is an incredible story. New York Magazine will want to write this. Sure, let's do it. So they say, yeah, we'll give you the documents. We'll co-publish with you. Let us know how you want to work out this. Within the first month of us starting to dig into these documents, kind of doing a little bit of, let's just verify, do some legwork, we got three more document dumps to us from anonymous sources. The story just kept on snowballing and getting bigger to the point where we realized this isn't just rewriting. This is a whole new story. Half of this stuff has never been reported before. The local papers didn't have the bandwidth to do it. They had to move on to the next election cycle. They couldn't go back and see what they hadn't looked at before, what they hadn't verified, the acronyms that didn't make any sense. And so, you know, Mario and I came on and joined them, and we spent 5 months kind of digging through all these ledgers, verifying with sources, interviewing people to see how legitimate this was, and we ended up writing, you know, a really great piece, and then from that spun out to two pieces with NPR that we did on how they were using newspapers and fake reporters to intimidate candidates that were calling for solar power and rate hearings, and doing that basically all to help their bottom line. And that was all just because, you know, you said let's work together and kind of make something that we can all be proud of.
I cannot recommend listening and reading this story enough. Highly recommend. You know, Sabrina, I'd love to hear a little bit from you about how you identify these stories that can make a big splash at the national level, even when, you know, unlike the story that Miranda's talking about, you're really speaking to that local audience. I'm thinking, for instance, of a story you wrote last year where you essentially revealed that gas interests were secretly helping to write a study at the University of Massachusetts, this very pro-hydrogen academic paper that later got published in a peer-reviewed journal. Surprise, surprise. Local institution, right? Local intrigue because of the impact on local climate plans, but caught a lot of eyes around the country. Tell me why you think that is.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of story that I think we all like to write, you know, that kind of puts the pieces together to show, like, the puppeteer that's working behind the scenes. And I will say, you know, working at a local publication, I have to find that in, like, why is this specifically relevant to our region, except for in rare instances when, you know, my editor might be on board with doing something that he just knows will be interesting. But for the most part, I'm looking for stuff that has a local hook. You know, in that case, I think, you know, that was one of those stories. I didn't know that it was necessarily going to have that national interest. I just knew it was a good story. I got a document dump of just like a FOIA dump, that showed the emails where the a lobbyist aligned with the gas industry was actually like rewriting huge chunks of this allegedly, you know, academic and unbiased report about the future of green hydrogen in Massachusetts. And you can see the track changes of where, like, you know, it shows his little name on the track changes. You know, there had been no disclosures. In fact, the disclosures at the end of this article indicated that there had been no interference and that there was nothing, to, you know, very explicitly saying, you know, hey, we're good to go, no issues here. And then in addition to that, I also was able to see through those emails that early copies of it had been sent to several kind of high-up folks at National Grid, which is the biggest, one of the two biggest investor-owned utilities in the state. Important context being that at the very same time, National Grid was putting forward a plan for like the future of how it was going to operate in the state of Massachusetts. And that plan, you know, they will say, you know, yes, we're very much supportive of this idea of electrification, and we want to have heat pumps in everyone's homes, but we believe that heat pumps will also require a backup system, and that system should be connected to our gas system or replace the gas with renewable natural gas, and of course, you guessed it, green hydrogen. So this was very relevant to their business future in Massachusetts. So the story came out, and it sparked a bunch of interest. You know, we have a pretty hard paywall. So it probably sparked the most interest nationally among people who had never read the Boston Globe before, because they could get that free article access. Because I think it might just be one free one that you get. But it was rewarding to see it go around a lot, and it did like lead to an investigation at the Journal, which I think is still underway.
Yeah, absolutely. In both of these cases, I think it's so important, I think, to help readers see the threads through the local stories that might be affecting, you know, the place that they live, even if they're not in, even if they're not in Boston, even if they're not in Alabama or Florida. Jake, in your book that you that was recently published, you tell the stories of a bunch of different places, right? You tell dozens of stories of dozens of people all over the country. Many of them may have not gotten reported out, I think, for a national audience had you not been there. But that required you to learn so many different, you know, local cultural practices, local policies, local histories. Why is that worthwhile? Why is it so important to sort of take the time to learn those local practices, those local policies for a national audience?
Yeah, I mean, I should also say, you guys, I don't think anyone will be mad if you come around and said there's definitely open seats.
Yeah, there's seats.
Not to pick on you, I just don't want you. I wouldn't want to be in the corner on the ground if I was trying to. No, just don't worry about that. I think that probably a lot of us have had the experience of, you know, if you write about climate change and you try to go tell a specific story in a specific place, you know, thinking that it has a national import or national angle, you start talking to people there, and they quickly start telling you, oh no, you don't get it, like, there's a very specific tree on a very specific road, and that has a very specific connection to this, and like, oh, you have to understand, like, that the subdivision was built 40 years ago, oh no, like, that gas line didn't get connected until that time, and they'll say, look, like, there's just so much, I mean, each individual community, any, like, a subdivision, anywhere, has so much complexity. It's just the built environment, the energy landscape in the US are just so profoundly complicated, right? That I think that you have to have a certain amount of humility and know that even if you think that there's a story that's of national relevance, you know, which like a lot of this stuff is, I think everybody would say that there's like a public interest in like knowing what happens when a giant hurricane like hits the coastal United States, right? Like we should know about this. People who live in inland states should know about this. But even if you think that's the point, right? To tell the rest of the country about this, the rest of the world, you have to have the humility to know that it's impossible to tell the story without knowing like the intimate, like really, 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 like gritty, often grisly details of the specific place where this is happening, right? And that doesn't mean they only need to go in the story, but I think that there's two things. One, I think you can't really build trust with the people that you need to talk to unless you demonstrate an interest in the welfare and like the history of where they live. But also there's just, I mean, it's just really, really, really complicated, right? Especially when you talk about natural disasters, the physics of flooding and fire, effluent. Like, these are very, 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 come on in. These are very, 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 like, physically complicated things, especially hydrostatic pressure, right? Like, just the way water moves. You can't just know that in the abstract by reading a study or by like looking at a national news article about the flood insurance program. You have to know how that stuff works like on the ground, right? So there's just like a lot of, I think you have to presume, start from zero, try to like immerse yourself in a place, and then if you want to go tell a story to the rest of the country, but look, this is what's happening, how FEMA is failing people, you know, after Hurricane Laura and Lake Charles, or like, look, this is how wildfires are affecting the housing crisis in the West. You know, you can't do that, I don't think, well, at least, until you know all the things that like are in the background of the story, right? That would be my contention. I don't know if that answers your question or not, but that'd be my contention, at least.
Yeah, can I just jump in? I mean, I feel like there's something in the specificity of people's stories too, though. Like sometimes the more detail you learn about it, actually the more universal it becomes,
yes,
right?
Because
people have a relationship to their communities, to their land, to the places that they live, and so even if like I live in a completely different place than you, I can relate to that feeling and that connection and that concern that you might have.
Right, yeah, and like the economics of like disaster recovery too, especially like equity in one's home, insurance coverage, these are things that almost every homeowner in the United States like has to think about, and they are like the primary like fulcrum of like what happens to you after, you know, like you get hit by climate change, right? So that's exactly it. Like, yeah.
Can I jump in too? And I will say, you know, sometimes where you feel like there's commonalities, there actually are direct links too. So for example, you could be reporting in Lake Charles and you could be looking at, you know, homeowner policy insurance and you're saying, why is this the case? Why are they pulling out? Why are they getting such high rates? Or you can be saying, this is a really interesting bill. Like, who's backing this? And you realize that this is part of a playbook. I mean, this can happen across states. These companies don't exist in vacuums. They oftentimes do have, you know, their hands in a lot of different communities and states. And so that's something that we look at a lot at Floodlight, is we, you know, look at these local stories. We want to tell them from a local perspective, but we also say, but is there a trend here? I mean, can we spend like 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you know, giving them four graphs, just explaining the step back here? What's the national context? Is this happening elsewhere? Is this a movement and a trend? Why should people reading this locally be concerned that this isn't just a one-off, that this is probably continuing, and other people who are reading this should be concerned that this might be happening in their homes as well?
It's a great point, and also I think relevant for when we're reporting on climate solutions, you know, on progressive policies, on, you know, grassroots attempts to make a difference. So often, you know, it's important to look at where a certain policy or a certain project has succeeded, has failed somewhere else, and why. I think it really helps to bring the story to life in the place where it's being tried. I'd love to ask all of you about how you can also sort of localize the bigger national stories or international stories. You know, I'm thinking, for instance, of the IPCC reports that are sort of heard around the world. How do we make those sorts of stories accessible to readers without just kind of repeating numbers, statistics, you know, kind of repeating that wonky language? How do you bring those stories to life for readers in a particular place and in a particular time? Sabrina, I'll start with you.
Great, so I'm gonna say, Darna, how did you do that at the Boston Globe? Something that you have very effectively done for our readers at the Boston Globe.
Why, thank you. You know, I think, well, it relates very, very directly, I think, to what you were just saying, Miranda, about kind of looking at the effects of certain policies and certain decisions in a place and looking at how they, you know, can be repeated or not repeated in other places. I think so often when we look at international climate policy, we focus on the international policymakers, you know, we focus on the sort of COP talks, things like this, and forget that, you know, it's local policymakers that are often, especially in the sort of absence of that strong leadership at the local level, or at the national level and at the international level, so often it's really local policymakers who are left to make the decisions that will change the world for better or worse. And so reminding readers of that, also reminding readers of the direct effects that they're seeing when, you know, temperatures rise, even just by, you know, 0.05 degrees or whatever, is really important. But Sabrina, would love to hear from you as well.
I don't know how much more I have to add to that. I mean, I guess one of the things I didn't say before that you just raised, it, when it comes to like the why local coverage thing, is exactly what you said. Like, I think that to the extent that until recently, we had like no federal legislation at all related to climate change, and it's still like pretty lacking. It is about up to the states, and so to the extent that you can look to what is the state committed to, and then hold them to that repeatedly, forever. that's sort of our job. But that didn't really answer the question you're asking, so I'll let Maria answer.
I have some insight. So, I think that national trend stories are great to apply to local stories because, they're nationally, they're especially if it's coming from globally, from scientists or federally from the government, it is going to impact everybody, but in different ways, very unique to their community. And so I think it's really important that reporters who are local reporters or even national reporters trying to figure out, again, how this is impacting, you know, everyday Americans. I think it's really important. My background is I used to be a Capitol Hill reporter. I covered the EPA and the Interior Department, the Department of Energy for 3 years under the Trump administration. Every single day I was writing the worst case scenario. They were cutting scientists. They were getting rid of climate change from their websites. And they were getting rid of all their science advisors. And there was all this kind of doom and gloom. I was working at CNN at the time, so lots of doom and gloom on CNN about what is this going to mean for us. And that really stuck with me after 3 years because I didn't know the answer. I was writing a lot of story about the worst case scenario, but wasn't writing any stories about, well, how is this actually trickling down to people? And so I actually ended up quitting my job and moving to California and freelancing because California was already seeing the immediate impacts of climate change. And I wanted to cover that and see how are these policies playing out? How are the lack of new policies that are addressing the changing globe playing out here? And so I think that, you know, when you have new things like the Inflation Reduction Act that, you know, passed, that is being rolled out steadily in states. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence about how that will benefit communities or potentially not be taken advantage of and actually not do what it's supposed to, or how other people are taking advantage of it in nefarious ways. Even things like carbon capture technology. We have an entire Gulf Coast team, and we're focusing a lot about how Louisiana and the Gulf is actually investing a lot in carbon capture. But a lot of people consider it a false solution because it benefits the oil and gas industries that we're trying to, you know, we're supposed to be ramping down with to hit our climate goals. So those are things that, you know, any local community can look at. This is a trend, but what is happening here? Are we, you know, doing that here as well? And I think that's an important thing to look at.
Absolutely. In any situation where a solution is posed or a suggestion is made, it's up to specific institutions, specific corporations, specific policymakers to actually take action. Jake, curious for you how these sort of bigger international policy, international reports, international policies play into your reporting. How do you sort of use those big splashy IPCC reports or the big splashy international stories in your reporting? And are they useful for you in telling the sort of local climate stories?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a really, really good like potential example here, right? Which is like whenever you read one of those reports, specifically the one like on impacts that came out, I think last year, they say like there's a tremendous amount of property at risk, right, from climate impacts and disasters. There's a tremendous amount of potential housing displacement across national borders and within, you know, individual countries. And then there's also, you know, potential solutions, right? And one of the solutions that gets talked about a lot is called managed retreat, right? Does everyone know what that is? It's like when the government basically pays you to leave or doesn't pay you to leave your house and they destroy it and then it's no longer vulnerable because it's not there, right? So like, I think that in those cases, right, like when you read the global picture in the report, I think that there's like a notion of like climate migration and like a mass pullback from like these sort of like sinking islands that gets leveraged in good and bad ways in an international conversation. But like, you know, I think, you know, one reason to like ground them in, you know, a local context is like, it often looks very, very different. The valence of it is very, very different from the way it sounds when you talk about it in a global way, right? So for Grist, I wrote this story about this town called Princeville. It's the oldest town in the United States chartered by the formerly enslaved in North Carolina. It got hit by a succession of hurricanes and floods between the 1800s and the late 1990s, early 2010s. And this was a place where, one of the first places where the federal government had tried like managed retreat policy. It certainly was a place where a lot of people had been displaced and a lot of economic value had been lost. But it just didn't look like any of the sort of global questions of who's going to stay, who's going to leave, what's fair, you know, where do people go, right? These are the questions that I kind of came in with, and the story that I kind of left with was about how it's kind of impossible for people, A, to leave, or B, to stay, right? They can't get back to their house, but they also don't have anywhere to go, and there's kind of this turbulent sort of process, people moving very, very short distances, or, you know, moves that they view as temporary, but then they come back, and there's like a governance issue with the town where, you know, nobody can really decide what to do, and no matter what decision they make, it's not really possible to execute the decision in terms of rebuilding or leaving. So this is just like a very, very highly nuanced, ambiguous, and frankly just kind of like painful situation. It doesn't look anything like the notions of like climate migration, housing displacement, economic value lost to disasters, right? And I think that, like, you know, obviously the history of that place is very specific. That's one reason why, like, it's such a compelling story, I think, is because, like, it's a lot of history that's been lost. But, you know, elements of this confusion are probably true, they're definitely true, across the world, and when you generalize all the way out to the globe, right, it all gets lost, right? So it's not to say that the reports aren't valuable, of course they are, but, like, they're talking about two different things, even though they're talking about the same thing, right?
I think that's really true. Really important to remember that the trends are not the story, the statistics are not the story. Ultimately, all these reports are about people,
yeah.
And the effects are vastly different for different kinds of people. You know, with that in mind, I'm curious your thoughts for everyone on the panel about parachuting. You know, this sort of notion that a reporter can just kind of be placed on a story in a particular place where they have little or no sort of context, they have no history in the place, and then can leave. There is an ethical question here, right, about this is the right thing to do, but then there's also a practical question of, you know, is it harder to sort of accurately report out a story in a place where you don't live? Sabrina, I'll start with you.
Well, I don't have to do a lot of that these days. Although I do live in Maine and report on Boston, which, if you're from New England, there's strong cultural differences. perhaps hard to see. But that's what I used to do. Like, I mean, as a reporter covering the Arctic, but doing it from either Brooklyn or Maine, that was my job. I will say, you know, it's like every time you're doing it not just for yourself, but for every other journalist that's going to come after you. Because if you screw it up, you have tainted the impression that these people have about journalists forever. So the biggest parachute I ever used was going into Nuiqsut, which is the Alaska Native community that's right next to where the Willow development was just approved by the Biden administration. I went there in 2017 for Inside Climate News. I think I was the first reporter that had ever gone there. I stayed at a man camp, which is like where all the drilling employees stay, owned by the very people that I was reporting on who were not psyched when they found out who I was. But when I got there, it took me days for people to even talk to me. And then as soon as they opened up, they were like, I can't believe you came here. And they were thrilled, but they were also clearly like entrusting me to not screw it up. And I don't think I've ever worked harder on a story than I did on that story, which was really about the concerns that they had about the, because they're already surrounded by drilling up there, and there's a really high rates of respiratory illness, especially among children, and some incidents that have happened in the past that have triggered kind of acute breathing problems in a community where there are no doctors and usually no nurses either. So I spent so long talking to these folks. I read them every word before the story ran, which is not something I typically do with sources, but I will with sources who don't deal with the media ever. I followed up with them. I continued to report on the community when I got back home and after the main story ran. And I stayed in touch with these sources, so I understand what their concerns are. I don't report on Alaska and the Arctic much anymore, but I generally know what my main sources are up to, and I make sure that they feel okay when they talk to journalists and that they know if something's going on, I'll connect them with someone that I trust and know will do good work, right? That was my job as someone who was parachuting in. Especially like if I'm talking about Alaska Native tradition and culture, which I did a lot of in that story, making sure that I'm saying, how would you describe this? Is it okay for me to even write about this? What does this mean? I was on a call with someone who said, she was like, I don't think you get it. Like, when we talk about who we are and the land, the only way that I can describe it is this, right? And she did that on the Zoom. And I was like, okay, there's not like a great word for it. So I just described that, right? Like letting her be the one who was took control of the way that she described this experience, because I am an outsider and I don't have the right to do that. So I think it takes a lot of work to parachute in ethically, but I do feel like it can be done. And I think it's important, because that story for those people would not have been told. There were no journalists there. And I know that they have really felt seen and valued that it came out.
It's a really beautiful story. Thanks so much for sharing. Miranda, curious your thoughts on parachuting.
Yeah. I mean, I think I agree with Sabrina in a lot of ways. I think that, you know, the unfortunate reality is that we live in a news desert, right? Like, local newspapers are drying up. The ones that exist are not necessarily the most reliable. There are just so many communities desperate to have people pay attention to them and listen to them, and there's a lack of trust in media because they don't really exist. Floodlight, most of our stories, we try really, really hard to work with local reporters for the exact reason that we don't want to have to parachute in. We want to be able to say, I did a story on utilities and a big winter freeze on Winter Storm Uri in Oklahoma. I partnered with Oklahoma Watch, a local nonprofit news publication, with one of their very, very good Capitol reporters. And he knew everybody in that state. I mean, and Oklahomans, if you've never been there, the nicest people you'll ever meet. Like, I was talking to people that were not happy about my story, and they were the kindest to my face, at least on the phone, ever. But they're all willing to chat with you, and they're willing to chat with me because they knew him, they knew Paul, and Paul knew the locals, and he knew what communities I should speak to. He spoke to them himself. You know, I had kind of a local guide, and I didn't have to go there and kind of figure it all out on my own. I had a reporter who knew this. He knew his town. He was from there. And so I felt really, like, satisfied with the story at the end, because I knew that I was representing it well because the local was telling me I was. But that's not always the case. A lot of the reporting that you want to do, there are no local reporters there. I think we were all probably at the opening session yesterday. One of the big awards went to a reporter who covered the Salton Sea, which is the area where there's a lot of lithium mining happening, but it also happens to be a horrible, environmentally neglected community. I spent basically a year covering that town during COVID because, as you can imagine, the years of neglect mixed with bad asthma issues, with arsenic-laced air, and then COVID on top of it in a largely Hispanic community meant that it had the highest death toll for a period of time in California out of any county. That was a really hard county to get people to want to talk to me. I don't speak Spanish. I'm not Hispanic. So I had to go back many, many times. And I drove around that lake. Salton Sea used to exist in historic times, but it's basically an accident, and it's drying up. And it takes 2 hours to go around. And I spent many, many hours just driving around, talking to different communities, getting people to finally feel comfortable that they could talk to me, that I wasn't just going to come in and write their story once and leave, because the area of the Salton Sea is kind of like, what do they call, ruin porn? I mean, they have a little bit of artists that live on the colonies there. They build structures, they have parties, and then they leave. But the communities that are stuck there, they've moved there because they can't afford housing anywhere else in the state. And they're stuck with the very, very limited resources and a horrible environmental neglect. And they don't feel like anyone's helping them. And so I really wanted to change that narrative, not only for me personally, because I obviously wanted them to feel comfortable talking to me, but for the same reason, I knew that there would be more reporters coming. And I wanted them to feel like, you know, they knew who to trust, who they could talk to, and that, you know, their stories did have importance and should be told.
A massive responsibility, to say the least. Jake, curious your thoughts on parachuting.
Yeah. I mean, I want to tell a story that's like the opposite of what Sabrina and Miranda did. So when I was working on the book, I went to a town called Pointe-Chen, Louisiana, which is like on the, so it's like about an hour and a half south of New Orleans. It's like right in the Gulf of Mexico, sort of, or it didn't used to be, but now it is. And it's right next to Ile Jean-Charles, which is like the famous first instance of a whole community climate relocation. And I was talking to a person there who runs this like tribal organization, and I was like, well, can I come talk to you? And she said, yeah, you know, come. This was a place that had already been written about it several times. And she said, yeah, come down and talk to me in this building. So I went there, and and there was like a Dutch TV crew already there, recording her for a separate story. And they were a place, as is Hilde Jean Charles, that's been so saturated with media coverage from parachute reporters that they had almost just reconciled themselves to the fact that there was going to be a never-ending deluge of national journalists coming in. And I knew I had to go there because it's like, it is like one of the places in the US where you can see climate change. It's in everywhere. It's such a profound place in that way. But I was like, what the hell am I going to do? You know, I can't just sit here and interview them at the same time as this. So I was like, I'm going to go away. I'm going to come back in a day or two. And I stayed like for like 2 or 3 weeks there, which is a luxury that I had because I was working on the book. Doing the same thing that you did, just drove up and down and up and down. And I was like, what if there's got to be something here that other people aren't talking about. And eventually I just like sat with people for so long, you know, just like dozens and dozens of interviews to the point where I was like, I'm just going to move here at this point. Like, and eventually, like, I just, one thing that I found that wasn't like in any of the previous coverage was like, everyone was talking about the place in terms of like, their family history in the place. And so eventually, instead of writing about the town or the tribal community, I just wrote about this family, the Verdants, that had moved there, you know, in the 1800s. And their like successive generations had different occupations, you know, shrimp fishermen, inshore shrimp fishermen, offshore shrimp fishermen, benzene tugboat captain, video game designer, you know, in successive generations, which I thought was like a pretty revealing way of talking about the process of coastal erosion. But I think that, like, in a way, that's like the right way to do it, by, you know, humility, like, to trying to take a long time. In the way, it's like kind of a wrong way to do it. And I think that, like, you can parachute well, but given what Miranda said about like news deserts and like just sort of like triage situation in the media industry, I think that like national reporters have to do like that extra, you know, 2 weeks of work to find, which I'm not saying I did in that case, right? Like, that's a town that I've been written about, although like book is a different thing. But there's like always another story, right? And so I think that you can do it well, but you have to make sure that you're doing something that's like additive, right? That you're not just like telling the same story that's been told before and saying, I'm gonna do it a little bit better this time. I think that there's like, you have to really be conscious of like, if you're a national reporter, sometimes you have like the resources to go to a place, do like a magazine article about it. You need to make sure that those resources are like, you're expending them in a way that's conscious of the rest of the journalistic landscape. You know, A, respectful of the work that local reporters do, of course, but B, just like, how can I make sure this dollar is like spent productively for the planet, you know?
Can I say something? I also think that something else to add is, and this is probably helpful for any reporter too, like, where do I start if I do wanna, you know, do a story like this, I really wanna go to a community, engage with community leaders. I mean, I always reached out to local mayors. I always reached out to Soap City Council members. I also reached out to environmental justice groups. I mean, they were the ones on the front lines of most of the environmental stuff that I'm working on. They're super happy to help you with people in the community. That was especially helpful for me in communities where I didn't speak the language because I needed to talk to someone who spoke English, or oftentimes they work as translators for me, which was significantly better than working with a translator, another outsider that I'm bringing in. This is someone who, you know, knew these people and was able to kind of make them feel more comfortable in conversations with me. And I also would say that I found libraries to be super helpful. Librarians love to talk. They know everybody. Book clubs. There's nothing better than finding already set communities where you can kind of just sit there and listen to them and pose a couple questions and then have them kind of spitball amongst themselves. It really gets people to open up. You feel like you get to know them, and you don't feel like you're kind of doing that awkward like one-on-one interview when you're trying to actually get to understand the pulse of the place.
Yeah, that's a great point. Finding the communities that already exist instead of trying to create them, I think, is a very good tip. I'm going to ask you all one more question, then I'm going to open up to the audience. You know, I think there's a tension in sort of reporting the climate story for an American audience, because obviously there are many places in the United States that are on the front lines of climate change that are seeing the effects more than some other places, but also, you know, there's the entirety of the global south. You know, there are places like Pakistan, there are places like the Maldives that are devastated by climate change in a way that many, many communities in the United States are not. Tell me about how you can bring those stories to the American audience, too. Is it important, I guess, first of all, to remind folks of the rest of the world, of its existence, of the importance of people in other places? And also, you know, how do you sort of balance the need to localize the climate story with the need to remind people that there are other people who are affected in ways that that could be coming for them, but even if they're not, that are important to remember?
So, I mean, I think it's super important to do that. You know, one thing that we did, you know, talking about the Pakistan floods, there was a reporter at the Boston Globe when the floods were happening. She just reached out to the local Pakistani community, and she spoke with people who, many of whom had family members who were being directly impacted, and who sent photos and videos, and she was able to interview them or talk about what they were hearing from people on the ground, and then broaden it out and contextualize what was happening. It was like it's like a right there kind of story to do. And I think the more that we can do that, the more we can see, like, we live in a global community, no matter what, there are these threads that connect us, and so trying to just show, Pakistan's not, it may be a long flight, but it's not that far away in that we're all part of it. Is one thing. And then the other thing is, there are these, like, terms of art that I think you can just employ regularly to make connections. And they're like, when you're a climate journalist, I feel like they almost feel like throwaway lines because they're so like, yeah, duh. Like climate change caused by emissions from the burning of fossil fuels. But like that clause is not a clause that has existed in newspapers until very recently, and even still it's quite rare to see it. And yet, it is the most important reminder to an everyday reader of why we're in this mess. But I also think quick lines about climate change, the effects of which are felt most severely by marginalized communities or you know, finding ways to make it clear that this is a bigger story than this one thing, and its impacts are not felt equally, right? Like, there are things that we can do to really kind of broaden it out. And, you know, when you're writing, I used to write for Inside Climate News, I would write like an 8,000 word story, and it would just run, because the internet lets you do that. But a newspaper, it does not let you do that. So you find real quick ways to get it in there when you can. And
definitely an art to the quick ways to getting it in there. Brenda, talk to me about reminding the American audience about the rest of the world.
Yeah, it's funny. I feel like a lot of this conversation we're having is about how to convince people that they should read these articles. And it's not to say that we don't think readers are going to read the story about Pakistan or the story about, you know, which I'm going to talk about, the massive heat waves that were happening in Europe. You know, people are going to read those, but it is, I think, helpful when people can contextualize, not just like, wow, that sucks for them, but like, oh, that's scary for us too. And so I think, you know, for example, when the heat waves were happening in Europe, or the massive forest fires were happening in Australia, there's some very obvious crossovers with heat waves we've seen in the US and forest fires we've had in California. And so those are really easy tales for us to say, tales of what to do or tales of what not to do, and kind of apply it to our states. I remember there was some really great, interesting crossover from the Australian forest fires, just in general, that there were firefighters from California going to Australia to help them fight the blaze because California was in its off season. But then there were also really interesting stories about how Australia is opening coal plants. And is the Great Barrier Reefs there are, you know, they're bleaching. And so this is a country of incredible, you know, wonderful ecosystems and biodiversity, but is still doubling down on fossil fuels, and this is what's happening to it. And so it's kind of also a tale of what can happen in the U.S. as well.
Jake.
I'll just add two things quickly. I mean, to echo the sort of like solutions thing that you were kind of hinting at, right? Like, I think that as the US confronts problems that like readers in the US are growing more aware of, I think that there's a lot of room to show like how other countries have Time of the Pump, you know, after Sandy, when the eastern seaboard cities were trying to figure out like what to do about, you know, coastal storms or anything, like literally, I'm talking about the Dutch a lot today, but they hired the Dutch to come in and like literally run these workshops with them when they said, well, how do you guys do it over in Rotterdam, which is quite an interesting, you know, way of managing water. You know, the international organizations have tried distributing anticipatory payments to people that they think will be at risk of flooding in the next 3 days rather than making them apply for aid post facto, right? This is a really, really interesting program. It's been tried in Bangladesh. It seems to work very well. Like, this is something that like American readers should know about because like there's no reason why we couldn't do that here, right? Like, have money. And then the second thing, I think it just goes the other way with like talking about the combustion of fossil fuels, where it's like, I think like when you, energy stories, right, like stories about the global energy mix are like, they're kind of de facto like ways of globalizing the climate story, right? Because like the barrel of oil that's produced in Saudi, like combusted in Germany, leads to the heating that then, you know, causes a sub-Saharan African famine, right? The famine doesn't come with a sign on it that says that, right? But like when you talk about energy, you have to talk about the fact, like you have to do the vice versa thing where you're like, you talk about the world's energy mix, LNG, coal, like you have to connect it back to like, well, this is gonna happen, so you keep doing it. That's, you said that already. But.
No, totally. It's also, it's an accountability story too, right? Yeah. Wherein, like, if the United States is the biggest historical emitter of greenhouse gases, the largest, you know, user of fossil fuels in world history, there's, I think it's very important to remind an American audience that those actions have consequences and they are felt deeply in many places that are not the US.
Yeah.
Great, thank you all so much. I'm gonna open it up for questions. A reminder that we're being recorded, so I'm gonna ask you to introduce yourself. So please introduce yourself as you say your question and I will repeat it back for the panel. Here, I saw you first, so I'll start with you.
My name is Jamie Broderick, I'm a financial reporter and I'm registered at NYU. And I was curious what local stories that you guys worked on that you thought was going to blow up and like really be a national thing didn't, and if there was any lessons to learn from that sort of story or certain characters or certain plot lines or something that might be instructive for the rest of us.
Great question. So to repeat, the question was essentially, were there local stories that you worked on that you thought would blow up, would get that big national audience that didn't, and why?
I was like, okay, I mean, the story that I did about Princeville, I don't know if my employers are in the room and they're gonna be like, yeah, that one didn't do too well. But like, I mean, everybody in that town, there's like some app that they use called like Newsbreak. Everyone uses it to get their news, and then I think that every single person, there's not that many people, it's like 400 people left. I think I'd say every single person read it. I think I talked to almost all of them. And they were like, oh, like, yeah, I read it, it was really good. I don't think, like, I can't recall even my friends reading it. Like, and so I was like, it's like one of those moments, right, where it's like, as a national publication, right, it's like, who are we doing this for? I mean, I'm sure we'll talk about this, right, but it's like, in a way, it was very satisfying, right? Because like everybody that I was trying to write it for and about felt really acknowledged, I think, and seen, like I got it right. But then it's like, you know, I don't know what it was that didn't make it blood. I mean, it's maybe just like Twitter was broken or something. But like, I don't know, you know. But yeah, it does happen, and it really makes you think. I think we could talk about this. Like, who is it for, right? Yeah.
I was just laughing because I've had friends straight up tell me they don't read my articles because they're too long. So, which I guess is important feedback. I've definitely had those stories that you spend a lot of time on. I spent a lot of time diving into data and documents on a story I did in California about how the state of California, which is trying to be, you know, climate leader, is still does a lot of carrots instead of sticks when it comes to how it gets businesses to transition over to renewable energy. And so it has a lot of grants that it gives to incentivize big companies to transition their trucks away from diesel. And I was able to look at all the grant funding and analyze millions and millions of dollars that it gives out to these companies every single year, including Disneyland, weirdly enough. And basically, the majority of that was still going towards transitioning to natural gas, not to electric, not to clean energy or anything. And so I found a lot of really interesting little scooplets in there, too. It did not
break. I mean, I still think it was a really important story to pull together. No one else was going to spend the time and energy to kind of find that narrative and highlight that, which I think is kind of what's great about being an investigative reporter is I do have that ability. But yeah, I mean, it didn't go viral on Twitter. So sometimes that just happens.
So I'm like in the opposite situation, right? Like, at Inside Climate News, sometimes a story would blow up, and usually it was because Leonardo DiCaprio posted on Facebook. We call it the Leo effect. Otherwise, it just generally, like, it's kind of a specific audience. Again, I believe that audience has grown more recently, but this was my back in the day. And then now, when something gets big, I'm like shocked and delighted, but I'm writing for a local regional audience, so I don't expect it. That's not necessarily who I'm writing for. And I just sort of feel like, okay, do that, you know? But it doesn't tend to happen, I think, again, because of the paywall. But I do find if it's going to happen, it's because I wrote about heat pumps.
Yeah.
People love heat pumps.
There is a weird thing that's, I think, at this point, almost a cliche where, you know, you can spend a month reporting out a story on the indigenous communities that are affected by the, like, Colorado River policies or whatever, and then you can write a story about Kylie Jenner taking a private jet in a day, and one of them will take off, and it's not the first one.
And that story was, like, the most popular story ever that you wrote. Like, it was, like, it was like a chart topper for the Boston Globe.
Yeah. Sometimes the ones that you write in, like, an hour and a half are the ones that take off. I'm going to go to you in the back.
Rachel Kukowski first. So I have a question about information access, which is kind of a follow-up to this question. You talked about paywalls, you talked about news deserts. So just some shameless self-promotion. At Grist, we're a nonprofit, so all of our content is available to republish for free. We co-report constantly with other newsrooms, we co-publish with other newsrooms, so we do everything possible to get our journalism in front of the people who should be reading it. And to get it out to the widest audience possible. So my question for you all is, especially the folks who work in print or with print, how do you feel about paywalls, and how do you feel about getting your journalism in front of the people who need to read it when there are these barriers to access?
The question is, how do you feel about paywalls, and how paywalls can create a barrier to access, especially for people who really need to read the reporting that you're writing?
Okay, I can take this.
Yeah, go for it.
employee. So how do I feel about paywalls? Delighted to have a job, delighted that we're growing our climate team. And that's probably because of the paywall. Like, the Boston Globe is a vibrant newspaper that has, you know, is growing and innovating and doing new things at a time when you don't hear about that a whole lot. So, like, that's awesome. But how do I feel about getting the right people to read it? Not good, honestly. I mean, I think it's a problem. You know, I this is like a shameful thing because I started a process and I haven't completed it, and it's sort of sat for probably at least like 6 months at this point. But I did start doing some outreach to a local Spanish language publication in the Boston area, and we started talking about how we could work together so that they could co-publish some of our stuff and they would translate it and co-publish it. But it was interesting. Like, it's a little bit of a hard sell for them to see the value in, to convince them of the value of doing that work, I think, because they're used to doing a very specific kind of niche reporting and kind of community news. So that's kind of funny to be like, will you please run our Boston Globe articles in your newspaper for free? So I think that's really the answer, is some strategic partnerships, especially to reach out to non-English language communities, because like when we write about environmental justice communities in Massachusetts, we're often writing about non-English language, English is the first language communities. You know, stories that we're interested in include stories about how the utilities are failing to really promote their energy efficiency programs in non-English language speaking communities because they're not finding people who can speak the language to go do that outreach. Okay, we're doing the same thing by not having other languages and also by having this barrier, which is our paywall. So I think it's a really hard thing. It came up actually in a conversation with our new editor recently of how do you strike that balance of reaching into those communities, but also recognizing we are a business, and if we don't continue to get paid for the work that we do based on the model that we we exist under, we can't keep doing the work that ultimately matters to this community. So it's a really hard thing.
So Floodlight is also a nonprofit. So and all of our partners are not necessarily nonprofits. We work with a lot of for-profit publications, but we try to, at the very beginning, before we really even enter into any partnership, make it very clear to them that we would like them to let us our stories in front of their paywalls if they have it. And it's kind of, you know, we don't argue it to the death, but it doesn't really make any sense if they do for a lot of reasons. The main one being, if we're going to co-partner with a national publication or local, it's already going to be in front of the paywall for them. So it's going to exist online on their publication for free. So it makes absolutely no sense for them to keep it behind a paywall for them because we're losing traffic. But also, the way that we work is we're offering our services. You know, kind of Floodlight, we are the investigative reporters. We either come to them with a story and say, let's co-partner on this, or, you know, we're offering them reporters for free. And so while businesses need to make money, and I totally respect as a reporter that paywalls need to exist to keep reporters' jobs, in our stories, we're like, well, in this particular instance, we are kind of, you know, investing in this story in halfway too. So we really try to get them to agree to say, for our stories, we'd really like them to be in front of a paywall because we want to make sure that there's access. That's kind of the basis of our entire company.
Right here. Yep.
Hi, Jen Miners from the Arizona Republic. I'm a climate reporter in largely rural red state, and I think that we all are aware that a lot of localized stories that become big national stories start because a local reporter embedded in that community did the legwork. And I think that we need everybody, and I totally respect, you know, the work that you guys do and the way that you localize. But I wonder if you could talk about, in light of, you know, local news shrinking and all these reporters out there, like huge disparity in pay and stuff between local and national reporting, how do we do the job elevating local stories to the national stage and like localizing stories via parachute journalism and things like that without like trampling the journalism foundations that are the reason that those stories are known?
So how do we respect the work that local journalists are doing while also being able to tell those stories for a national audience, I think is the gist of the question. Am I getting it sort of?
I just want to push back on that narrative a little bit because I actually think that more stories is better than fewer stories. And so you're definitely right that there are oftentimes reporters that break great news in local places and then big publications come in and kind of take them over and don't give credit. I can think of dozens of stories right now that fit that bill, and that's, I don't think, great journalism at all. I think that what those reporters should do is reach out to those local publications, those local reporters, and partner with them and try to find the next big story. But I do think that national publications coming into areas and writing about them can elevate them and drive more interest to that area, which can then hopefully benefit that area and realizing, oh, we should have more local reporters on this beat. We should actually have that reporter cover that more. Maybe this wasn't just a one-hit story if there is so much interest. And so I think that there hopefully can be a really beneficial relationship that happens. I know that journalism was started where we're all behind paywalls, we all were fighting with each other, we all felt like we had to kind of elbow each other for scoops, but I really do think that the changing media landscape means that more and more reporters can actually work together to benefit their stories, other people's stories, and make everybody happy instead of feeling like they're all being taken advantage of. And
can I clarify for a minute?
Yeah.
I absolutely agree that more stories is better, and I think that a lot of these like stories that start local should be told nationally, absolutely, and they should be told nationally by national publications. But if a reader in Arizona sees the same story reported in the New York Times and in the Arizona Republic, a lot of times they're going to feel like, oh, well, I can just subscribe to the New York Times, I'll get everything, and I can cancel my local subscription. So how do we work together to make sure that that doesn't happen? That's not the like conclusion that people come to.
Yeah, 100% agree. I mean, I feel like I've been on both sides of this. My first job, I was at this like little tiny newspaper in Massachusetts, and I'd be so mad when I would write a story and then the Boston Globe would come down and cover it. Now I'm with the Boston Globe, and I write a story, and every now and then I get so mad when a big national publication comes in and writes a story and doesn't give me any credit. So oppressed. But it's I, I think it's a really hard thing. I think that there is a culture that started with that kind of older kind of competitive mindset that we're still stuck in a lot of ways, of not giving the credit. I think if you're reading that story in the New York Times, but it says, as first exposed by the Arizona Republic, and not just like first, right, like really lean into the credit. Don't just link out, exactly.
Which they don't do.
And we don't do it, and I think that we as a community of journalists should commit to dragging people publicly when they don't do it. Because it works, you know? You see it on Twitter all the time. And like, let Twitter be an agent of good for once.
Yeah, that's a really, really good one. I mean, I think it's like when you, there's a lot of like, you know, like ethical bare minima, right, that you can adhere to, right? Like certainly linking, crediting, like, and then without like sort of like making the local reporter like do work that they're not getting paid for, like I always like check in with the local reporter, you know, because like I did this story like in Cochise County about the AMA petition, right? And it was like, I only knew about it, right, because like somebody wrote an article in the local paper saying like, hey, there's going to be an AMA petition. I knew what that was, and I understood the import, and I wanted to write about politics of groundwater, right, and water regulation, which is like the wild, wild west in a lot of the west, right, that there just literally is no regulation, and that's sort of starting to change in a lot of places, right, so I thought that was a story that like Grist's readers should really know about, because A, like there's a lot of like misconceptions about our readers about like the politics of rural areas, but B, like people just don't really understand like what groundwater is and how it works, so like, you know, I just, there's like some, we linked a lot in that story, I think we credited a lot, and then HCN had done a story on it recently. We like worked with the same photographer. He went out there and like I like had him read the story. He had been pretty embedded there. I was like, can you read this story and like just like let me know like what do you think's additive here? What do you think's not useful? Like where do you feel like you're not being given enough credit? And like we worked. He was in Tucson, out of Tucson, I think. I'm certain. And like that was like I just felt like you know there's obviously some. I think it's always like a little unsavory. Because of that competitive mindset, right? But like, when you talk about like the sort of triage nature of journalism right now, like there's obviously a need for like, I mean, we're not even coming close to like saturation in terms of telling the story of climate change, but then you just have to kind of like start from like what's obviously the bare minimum, and then just like listen and try to be like humble while still recognizing that like, for a national readership, there's a story that you could tell about a phenomenon or a place that isn't the story that the local reporter is telling. It's about the same things, but it's, you know, you're talking about something different, and that's valuable still, you know. That's a good one.
That's a great question. Oh, we're unfortunately at time. But we're all,
yeah.
I know. But we're all, thank you all so much for being here. Also, we're all around, so if you have more questions, please come find us, come chat. Thank you all for being here, and thank you all for your great questions and engagement.